The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. In 2015, we published Nicholas Hofstorf's Superstructural Berlin, a book that plays around with critical theory in order to provide the reader with an impressionistic picture of Berlin's nightlife, drug culture, and tourism industry. Since the publication of his book with Zero, Nicholas has moved to the right and started writing for a reactionary online zine called Jacobite. Given his transformation politically, Zero Books won't be publishing his work again. In this episode, I invited him onto the podcast to explain to him why this was the case and to debate his ideas to the extent that he has any. It's Wednesday, September 26, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to remind listeners that Zero Books produces two podcasts every week, one for free and one for people who support us on Patreon. We also run a YouTube channel featuring video essays from myself and the Zero Books team, and we have just started a Zero Books reading group. The next book on our reading list will be Stuart Walton's Neglected or Misunderstood, introducing Theodore Adorno, and patrons who support us at $15 a month will receive access to that ebook or a PDF version when they sign up on Patreon. The music you're listening to right now is entitled Everybody Dance when translated to English and was composed by Harari's Nunes Santiago in the 13th century. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Nicholas and I discuss why socialists reject reaction.
Why don't you introduce yourself and then we'll get started.
I'm Nicholas Hofstorf, and I believe I'm a vicious reactionary.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we got that out of the way right at the start. Go ahead.
Yeah, I thought I'd just come right out with it.
So, look. You're the author of
Superstructural Berlin.
Hmm.
I hope it's still going to be a classic at some point. I think it holds up.
Okay, and. But since then, well, tell me this, Nick. Before, when we published your book, did you have different political views than you have now?
Yeah, I nuanced them. I nuanced my views, but I don't think they're entirely different. I think if you read Superstructural Berlin, you'll find the same themes.
Well, I recall our interview about that book and reading that book in 2015, and finding that the book was, you know, not the book I would have written, but that it had a sort of a relationship to the situationists and it was sort of an impressionistic book more than it was a theoretical book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, it's a frivolous book. I mean, it's not high theory.
Right.
That would be ridiculous. It was a device to, yeah, perhaps an aesthetical device to also convey some information. Yeah, I still think, you know, the footnotes are pretty good. So, that's an interesting book, but it was an experiment.
Right. And that's why we took it on. It seemed of the left, if not Marxist particularly. And, it seemed like it would be an interesting read and kind of a fun little book to put out there. But since then you've started writing for Jacobite.
Yeah. And then it caused me your ire.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not even that I'm angry with you. It's just that Jacobite is, a reactionary magazine and you're not writing for it from a perspective that's not in line with this editorial mission. You are a Jacobite writer now. I mean, having read your work there.
No, don't get me wrong. I'm super happy to write for them. I think they're probably Jacobite is the magazine that's putting out the most interesting stuff at the moment. So I was really delighted. I think Rob Mariani, who, by the way, I haven't met personally, but I think he's doing a great job as an editor. And what's the other name? J. Arthur Bloom, I think. Yeah, I think that they're doing a really good job.
I mean, listen, it's a free country in the United States, and as far as I'm concerned, it should be a free world. If you want to write for a reactionary magazine and love it, you know, that's fine, but it's not where our politics are at Zero Books. So it wasn't so much my ire. It's just like, you know, oh, he's on the reactionary side against the progressive Marxist side.
Look, I think if you read Jacobite and you read all of the articles, you'll see that this is, that's a nuanced outlet. And I think part of the good editorial job they're doing is that they're putting out a number of different ideas. And like, I really don't care. Like, you know, like if you think that reactionary is the label, you know, you want to put on me, like that's perfect.
Well, it's not, I'm not putting it on you, like, because I'm putting it on the ideas, right? I mean, you can change tomorrow. You might be a great, I don't know. You could become Catholic tomorrow, and in 5 weeks' time, maybe.
I am Catholic, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You know? So that's probably not the wrong choice, but you could become, I don't know, a Scientologist in a week. And then, you know, and I would characterize Scientology a certain way. It wouldn't really be about you, right? And so the same thing about Jacobite and writing for Jacobite. It's not that I'm trying to label you as a person down to your soul. I'm just saying, the positions that you're taking are reactionary and nationalist.
Okay. So yeah, well, and nationalist, I probably agree with that. But okay. I do think, you know, like, first of all, I doubt, you know, whether nationalism is reactionary today. You know, like, that depends on your perspective. But you know, like, that's what I mean. I mean, these, you know, it's tough to use these words. You know, like, I think that, you know, like, that they've just lost. You know, like, it just means something else to everyone, you know. So I don't really think that, you know, like, you can make much progress with.
So, well, what do you think the word reactionary means?
No, I don't know. Like, I mean, you explain it to me. I mean, I don't really know. Like, reactionary to me is the opposite of progressive. And those things are like, you know, that's like.
Yeah, that's about right. Reactionary is a desire to return to a previous.
Battle notion, you know, like that means something different to everybody else, you know, like, I mean, the reactionaries you're describing, they probably think they're, you know, like in some way progressive in that they're, moving history along, you know, like even if it's, you know, even if that means, you know, like, I mean, this today's movement, I would say is like a retro conservatism. And that retro conservatism, you know, that's retro. You know, retro is like selectively choosing things from the past, you know, like, and sort of trying to end the, you know, period of aesthetical and political modernity, which is like this sort of ruthless experimentation in which, you know, like, sort of people are trying, you know, starting to find out that this is not really going anywhere. So in a way, there is something, you know, very progressive about being a conservative. So that's what okay. I would say.
Well, all right.
I mean, okay. Explain to me what you mean by reactionary.
Okay, here's what I mean by reactionary. So reactionary means that you want to return to a political formation or a social order or an economic system that is prior to modernity. That's what. Prior to the bourgeois revolution, prior to industrialization, perhaps even prior to mercantilism and international trade. Often enough, it's associated with monarchism. Okay, so that's what I would think of as reactionary.
I think by the way, there's a good case for monarchy is not absurd. I've listened to some people making that argument before, and before that I thought monarchism, that's got to be a joke, you know, that people like seriously discuss this, but there is some, you know, like serious thought about this.
Okay. So, I mean, that's fine. So what I hear you saying is some of the reactionary ideas might be justifiable. They might be correct. They might be better than progressive, what we call progressive ideas, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, like the next step is, of course, you know, what do you mean by progressive ideas?
Right. Well, that's difficult too. I would say a lot of what dresses itself up as progressive is sort of small scale reactionary. So for instance, there's a tendency to want to return to the New Deal and to the 50s and 60s in America. As if we can just retreat into a certain moment in the development of capitalism and, as if things hadn't moved, as if that moment hasn't passed, and without considering what the conditions needed to be for that moment to, arise. So.
Exactly. But, you know, that's precisely the problem. I mean, like, just in general, to have this idea that you could just like return to things, that is probably false in itself. So I wouldn't describe the genuinely human category is history. You know, people are, you know, humans are historical beings. So we, of course, like interact with history, you know, like dialectically, you know, it's not possible to return to things. But I mean, like, if you mean, like, I think, for example, you know, you've asked me, you know, what has changed ever since Superstructural Berlin. And, you know, like, I would probably say, yes, there is some sympathy with a specific set of right-wing ideas. And I think perhaps that's also like in, you know, like a coming to terms with, you know, like ideas about hierarchy and also, but also the failure of sort of these like progressive visions of the world as, you know, like everybody is, you know, like equal, not in a sense of, you know, everybody is equal in terms of rights, but everybody is equal in terms of like creating some sort of perfect equity.
Right. In other words, you, like many people, in the center of the conservative movement, like for instance, let's say even someone like Sam Harris or, Jordan Peterson,
I'm not familiar with Sam Harris.
Do you know about Jordan Peterson?
Yeah, I do know. If you listeners can read, I wrote an essay on him.
But the point is that Jordan Peterson also would agree with you that, you know, we shouldn't be aiming at equality of outcome.
Yeah.
To make a better society.
I don't think it's gonna work.
I mean, that's also the message of the Disney or Pixar film The Incredibles.
I don't know this film, man. Like,
you don't know it?
No.
Okay. Well, you got to catch up on American pop culture.
No, I don't. Like, no, I would never watch such a thing. You know, like I'm, you know, like I'm a European, and you know, like this is something, you know, where.
Well, what I would say is that the ideas you're espousing can be found in the Disney film, so you might as well go down to that level because you're already there.
No.
So anyhow,
that doesn't mean watching Disney films, you know, like that's an idea of culture that I don't share, you know, like, I mean.
I understand.
Yeah.
But the point is that the ideas in that film are about as complicated as the ones you're espousing. So the thing is that no one really believes in equality of outcome. Not in the way that Jordan Peterson means it, not in the way that you mean it.
Yeah.
So that's a non-starter. It's an argument against nothing.
Yeah. Fair enough.
So,
things, you know, like if you actually wrap them up, they are arguments against nothing. You know, but you know, people still use those labels, and then you know, like, or I find you like, you're in Zero Books, you know, like, you know, somebody tells me, tweets, oh, they're not going to publish you anymore. I mean, you could have just also told me that directly, you know?
Well, okay. I let me tell you that directly right now. I'm sorry that I didn't tell you directly at the moment. I'm sort of a conflict avoider. So I should have told you that we weren't going to publish you anymore. But, you know, we could still publish you if you have a break from Jacobite and come to us and say, hey, I want to write a book about all the ways the reactionaries are wrong. We could publish you again.
No, I don't espouse that, and I don't believe in that. Like, but why would I stop writing for them? You know, like they want to publish me. That's great.
Well, I understand.
You know?
I understand. Michael Tracy is a left wing.
Part of the problem as a writer is that you know not everybody wants to publish.
Sure,
you,
I understand.
Like, I think especially people on the left are much more close to, you know, they're not open for ideas, you know, like, and if you like have, you know, ideas that are sort of not fitting perfectly into the one or the other side, you know, like it's, well, what I have experienced, it's rather the right that's open to that. And I think that's something to think about, you know, like, and you know, like me personally, I'm a writer who's like always, you know, like, looked at critically and suspiciously from both sides. So, you know, like, I don't really care.
Right.
You know?
Well, look, there's a difference between running a journal and running a book publishing company. If I were running a journal, I might run a piece from a reactionary and with up against a progressive, just to have the ideas tested. But I can't publish a reactionary book. In its totality, although I think we have in the past, actually.
Bill, explain to me, like, then, you know, what it is in particular, you know, that you find disturbing about, you know, like the things that I write, or is
I don't
it
think
just it,
you're
I write?
Disturbing. That's the wrong way to characterize it. I just think that your ideas are wrong.
So which ones in particular?
Well, let's go through some of them. I mean, you wrote that the current crisis of globalization and the recurrence of nationalisms is also the crisis of U.S. imperialism. And I want to ask you, what do you mean by that? What is it that, you're pointing to? I mean, I would say that the current crisis of neoliberalism is not a crisis of, globalization, but of neoliberalism, which we can discuss the difference there. And that the upsurge of reaction is not the result of some failure of policy per se, but is really the result of the economic crisis of 2008 and the contradictions within capitalism.
Yeah, I don't know about that. You know, like I'm always like, you know, like skeptical when capitalism becomes this like catch-all phrase. You know, like, and you know, like sort of monomania. And I'm not opposed. You know, it's the same thing. You know, what do you mean by capitalism? You know, like, I mean.
Well, I can tell you, capitalism is a system wherein we produce products primarily for exchange in the pursuit of a certain kind of value defined by labor time. You can find a really good description of it in Capital.
No, that's really already like a very interesting definition of capitalism, you know, like, because, you know, like producing products, you know, for labor time. You know, that's talking about a certain, you know, like productive capitalism, you know, like, and, you know, like, I think you can easily differentiate between different forms of capitalism, you know, like, and, you know, like ideal models and perceptions of capitalism and, you know, like what the way capitalism actually works, you know, like, and all of these things are, you know, like different and refer to different things, yet they're all subsumed under the word capitalism, you know, it's like a complete semantic confusion, you know, like, and I think there's a big difference between, like, you know, like the sort of financial capitalism, you know, like is sustained by U.S. military power, you know, like basically forcing, you know, like producing non-value and forcing the world to take it, and productive capitalism. I think those are two entirely different things, even though they're, you know, there's interactions between them, you know. And
well, I would say that once you look at the interactions between those two realms, between financial capital and productive capital, what you'll see is that they are components of an overall system that like financial capital has to exist in order for a certain form of production to exist, a certain way of reproducing our lives to exist, you have to have certain institutions like financial capital or the property capitalists.
It's imprecise, you know, like this is sort of, you know, like scientific Marxism, you know, that puts it all into a system and, you know, like doesn't really care about, you know, like individual people, you know, like I think, you know, like capitalism is like an easy and complacent critique in a way, because, you know, like everybody can make it and you're not going to get into any trouble if you critique capitalism, you know, like if you start going deeper and, you know, like start to criticize people, you know, like that's the domain of investigative journalism, you know, like if you look at the individual like Ponzi schemes on Wall Street, you know, and how that causes deterioration in morals and like sort of the worst excesses, you know, that this is where it starts to get dangerous, you know, like you couldn't do that as an academic or as a Zero Books publisher, you know, you'd get lawsuits and stuff, you know.
Well, maybe, but the point is that you said that the Marxist critique doesn't care about individuals, but in fact, the what we would say is that the system doesn't care about individuals. The system is a way of controlling and directing the lives of individuals, and that in order for individuals to be free, they have to break with this mode of production and produce the world in a different way, developing a different system. And as far as this thing about, oh, well, it's not a very risky or edgy or important critique because you won't get in trouble for doing it. Well, you might get in trouble for doing it, but I don't look at the accumulation of lawsuits or personal struggles with individuals as to be the measure of my politics. I'm not out here trying to pose as a rebel, you know.
This is where the real politics is, you know, like, and if you pay attention, politics is where there's lawsuits, where there's violence, and where there's suicides, but you know, the suicided, you know, and you look at these and you can make a map of things that are really critical to power.
Okay, so what's your definition of politics that leads you to say that? Other than just a sort of emotive, you know, oh, well, politics is where there's violence. What is it about being that marks something as being political when there's a suicide or when there's a violent struggle? Why is that the mark of politics?
Look at it this way. I haven't dealt a lot with political theory ever since I was a university student, you know, which is like almost 10 years ago. Because I don't really find it productive, you know, like I think it's important to go the other way around, you know, you look at news items and from that you can deduct what politics actually is and not the other way around, you know, it's just too difficult to, you know, like use some of this, you know, like theory, like, you know, let's say Marxism, you know, Marx is brilliant. Don't get me wrong. Like, you know, like it's something really, really enjoyable to read it, you know, like just like this entire endeavor and the way it has changed the world, you know, like it's, you know, fantastic, you know, perhaps frightening to some, but, you know, no doubt that this is like, you know, like some of the most interesting theory that's ever been written, you know, but I mean, In terms of observation and politics, I don't think it's going to get you very far unless you'll always end up with the critique of, you know, the system is wrong. And then your choice, of course, becomes like you have to pull down the system. But that doesn't solve the problem of power. Not at all, you know.
No. Okay. So let's talk about that. So I have two questions about your problem of power. How do you conceive of the problem of power, and what is your political project to try to do something about the problem of power?
I mean, I don't have obviously an elaborate political, you know, project, because I think those things are vain. You know, you look at sort of politics is about trying to bet on the people who most represent your interests, you know, like, and sort of strengthening the forces, you know, whether that be, you know, like in a way of metapolitics or, you know, like concretely supporting people. But I learned a lot from talking to the, you know, like the programmers and like their ideas of, you know, like trying to inscribe decentralization in architecture. You know, I think this is the thing that makes the most sense. You know, like you try to aim for somewhere that provides maximum freedom and maximum decentralization of power, you know, like, and try to sort of inscribe contradictions between different instances of power. And that's very difficult. That's very difficult. But I think, you know, one of the people who is decentralizing power is Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
You know, and you can see that because there is, I mean, like, I think everybody can agree that, you know, that there is a degree of chaos in the U.S. elite right now. You know, that's pretty undeniable. There have been, like, for, you know, some time in Syria, there have been two U.S. foreign policies. I mean, what does that tell you about the state? You know, like, that's completely incredible. And, you know, whether you like Donald Trump or not, you know, I think it makes sense or the rational choice for you if you're interested or if you're serious about anti-imperialism is to bet on this contradiction, you know, like, because the contradiction is not, you know, it's making the empire weak, you know, and I think that's extremely interesting.
You've at first tried to say you didn't have a political project, but you really do. And the aim of your politics is to decentralize power, to spread power out as evenly as possible and to empower people on the local level in their everyday life and in their own communities so that they can be kind of the masters of their own fate. So that is not at all out of step with the aim of socialism or Marxism, as I understand it, that is the aim.
No. Exactly. But, you know, like the thing is, like, if the people on the right here, socialism or Marxism, like, they shit themselves, you know, it's like, oh my God, you know, that means, like, you know, we live in the Soviet Union, you know, and on the other way, it's like, you know, you shit yourself when you hear reactionary. It's like, oh my God, you know, like you're writing for Jacobite. But in reality, that's all I'm writing about. You know, it's like decentralization, you know, like, and I think Jacobite is smart enough to see that, you know, like, and a lot of that stuff is actually quite similar. You know, like people look at the, you know, like problem of power as maximum cynicism. And they try to find out, okay, what's the best way to achieve maximum freedom, you know, like, and, you know, like, do so, you know, and
The difference between your position and mine is not so much uninformed people's reaction to our different political positions. That's not what I would say really we should look to in order to distinguish between our two sets of ideas. But, you know, what we think is limiting people from having power and why power gets centralized in the world as it is now. So we have different explanations, primarily, I think, of how power gets centralized. You think of it primarily in terms of kind of tribal political decisions. And I think of it in terms of the way the economy functions.
Well, I mean, obviously, there's not a, you know, like a clear cut distinction to be made between those.
There
things.
Isn't, especially if you have no concept of the economy. If you have no economic theory, then you really won't make any distinction between the political decisions and power and tribalism and the economy, because you don't have a conception of the economy.
It's not like I don't have a theory.
Okay,
of the
well,
economy,
what's what? So, like, how does the economy? What's the basis of the economy? Like, how do people make a profit in the world?
The economy is entirely geopolitically overdetermined, mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people just, you know, they don't see that. But that is the case, you know. Like you sort of, you know, that's one of the things I learned. Also.
So when you say geopolitically overdetermined, what does that mean?
When you talk to people in politics and you understand the way that, you know, politics or the economy sort of entirely derives from geopolitical constellations, I think you get an idea. And I think you also get an idea of what to work on, you know, what's the easiest thing to work on, perhaps, and what to bet on. Your question is, what does it mean, you know, geopolitically overdetermined?
Yeah, right. I mean, I think that's, when you said it, I think that's a rather empty thing to say, because I don't think it means anything. I think it's a bunch of buzzwords. But go ahead.
Well, I mean, you look at the U.S. economy, you know, which is essentially speculation, you know, that is, You know, that's the great part of it, an intellectual property, you know, that only holds up by military force.
Uh-huh. Well, we are the second most productive country in the world.
Yes, but you are because your economy has the support of the State Department that everybody fears. You know, if not, you'd be like quickly obliterated by the German and the Chinese economy. I think everybody knows that.
How so? They're producing more goods than we are?
Yeah, they're producing more goods and they're producing better quality goods, you know, like, and the U.S. is sort of, you have the State Department support, you know, like you're active across the world, you have your military bases everywhere and you're forcing people to buy your products.
Right. So you think that controlling the market is where, controlling the market is what creates, power in the world.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's based on military force. I mean, nobody buys the dollar because they want to buy the dollar. They buy the dollar, you know, like it's the lead currency, not because it's inherently stable, because people, you know, inflate it all the time. Your Federal Reserve inflates the dollar all the time. They buy the dollar because they're forced to do so. And if they don't do that, you know, you've seen what happened to Gaddafi, you know. I mean, he got publicly sodomized and murdered, you know, by the cronies sponsored by the State Department.
So you're saying that that economic power is really determined by the value of the currency of a state. And do you believe in fiat currency? Like that money is basically just an expression of political power?
It's determined by the, you know, like ultimately by military force, you know, like by the way that you can sort of force other people to accept the value of your currency.
See, this is where you and I differ, because I don't believe that. I don't believe that currency, the value of a currency is fundamentally based on the power of the military. I think that, you know, if you gave North Korea a nuclear bomb that could then destroy the world, like a doomsday device, and they were threatening everyone with it unless that we bought their products, they still would be a backwards country because they wouldn't have the productive forces necessary to produce at the level which could, you know, create profits for them. That the source of profit is the amount of labor power that you can bring to bear on producing commodities.
I think the North Koreans, they're holding up quite well. You know, like, I mean, look at them. You know, like they're a country like that's under sanctions, you know, like, and
I'm not saying that they're doing that. They're like,
they must be an excellent people, you know, like to sort of like do, you know, like they fare pretty well, you know, like for being cut off from the entire world. And, you know, like
in terms of, they certainly are nowhere near as powerful a country in terms of economically powerful as, say, France.
Yeah, of course, because they have a different history and they're a small country of like.
Exactly. Yeah. So they don't have the material resources in order to produce at the level to be a major powerhouse.
What does your example even mean? I mean, you know, like you're talking about empty words and here you come with this like entirely fictional scenario.
Well, it's just an example. It could be, you know, take Nigeria, or you could take any underdeveloped, relatively isolated country and give them a lot of military power, the power to create violence in the world, and they're not going to be able to suddenly be a rich country, because the wealth and value in a country has to do with the success of the productive forces, the success of, you know, the process of exploitation of labor and the creation of commodities. And be able to compete as a productive force in the world. That's why, you know, China and India are doing really well, because they've been able to amass the working classes together and to be very productive. And that's why they're probably gonna, both of them will be more productive than the United States within, you know, relatively short order. But that, I mean, I think China already is. So China's not more productive and more powerful economically than the United States because of its military might. It's not because it's rattling its sword. It's because it can produce cheap goods on a massive scale.
Well, but that's of course, you know, that's part of the Chinese power, is that they actually, you know, like they managed to create some you know, like that they managed, first of all, to procure the nuclear bomb, you know, which makes them inattackable, you know, which is the same thing North Korea did. You know, that's military force, you know, like, and second of all, like creating a vicious police state, which is the only thing that keeps the country from, you know, like being subverted, you know, which is like the tragedy of a lot of states. You know, it's like people always say, oh, you've become an authoritarian regime and this is why you deserve to die. But it's, you know, a lot of times it's because they're being infiltrated left and right. And, you know, like then they have to become increasingly paranoid to sort of.
Do you think of the
security.
World economy as a zero sum game?
That's not.
Do you think of the world economy as a zero sum game?
Of course not. But it is being set up as one. That is the reality of it. You know, like people set it up as a zero sum game. You know, that's what happens. Not that I'm saying, it couldn't be otherwise.
But I mean, under capitalism or in today's society, let's say blame it on the Jews if you want. But do you think that today that we have that system?
That it's not set up in this way. You know, like, I mean, why, you know, like do those things not happen? You know, it's like the same. I guess that's the sort of the capitalist realism argument, right? Like from Mark Fisher, you know, like I think David Graeber in some similar ways, like the sort of, you know, why is the imagination so destroyed that it precisely that doesn't work? And this is where I'm, you know, like that is my political stance. Like how do you sort of create the structural conditions so these things can happen? Because you can't just like keep moving back and saying, oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, what things do you want to have happen again?
You have to accept power relations, you know, like, and work from that. You know, that doesn't mean you have to accept them as absolutes, but you have to work with them. You can't ignore them completely. You know, that's what Lenin calls the, you know, like the eternal return of the concrete.
Well, I wouldn't say that we have to ignore power relations, but I wouldn't want to reduce, the world economy to a battle between powerful nations on the level of military might and politics. What, you know, I wouldn't want to say the reason the United States has been so successful in the world is because of its ability to be really great at creating propaganda and because of its military arsenal. That's not what I think would be adequate to describe what's going on.
Yeah, that would be precisely. And, you know, with propaganda is a really good point, I think, you know, because I think the Anglo-Saxons have always been extremely successful because their propaganda has been excellent. You know, especially if you compare it to the Russian propaganda or the Nazi stuff, you know, it's like, it just can't compete, you know, I think it's quite subtle. You know, up until now, at least, you know, I think that something's going wrong.
Reactionary. Adjective. 1. Politically favoring a return to a better previous state of things, to a supposed golden age of the past.
I think that you've got it backwards, that imperialism isn't the end goal of the expansion of capital and the concentration of capital in a few hands. But is the consequence of that movement of capital and the concentration of capital. In other words, as your company grows or as a nation becomes more and more powerful economically, it will be pushed into an imperial situation in order to maintain its rate of growth, in order to continue to be successful.
Yeah.
It will have to seek other markets. It will have to.
That's an entirely virtual notion. I mean, these days, like, things don't really grow anymore except, you know, like sort of as money value. And in, you know, like you see streets deteriorating while there's like formal growth, you know, like, so those things, they don't really mean anything, you know, they're like entirely virtual things. And behind them is always the desire for power, you know, like, and you always have the possibility to regulate competition by regulating your border, you know, and then you're not forced to have like infinite growth. And, you know, like you see this, if you have like open markets, for example, between small and big countries, so between the US and Germany, and in Germany, you see all of the retailers, like they're just evaporating under the pressure that comes up with Amazon, you know, like, and it would be easy to sort of just, you know, like, regulate this open market, you know, and that's exactly what Donald Trump is doing, you know, and but, you know, that is, of course, you know, there are certain people who don't like that, and it's the people who have, you know, like this sort of financial capital, and they want that financial, they want to have, continue to have this leverage over other countries by sort of withdrawing and supplying money at a moment's notice. You know, that's essentially like what these, you know, like, you know, funds in Wall Street do, you know, like this is.
I think it's important to look at the difference between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in terms of what sorts of interests they represent. And I think that Trump represents the interests. He thinks like a real estate guy. He thinks like someone who owns property. And when it comes to charging rents and owning property, and especially intellectual property, because he's also big into branding, he thinks like someone who thinks that a trade is a zero-sum game. You get more than what you give in order to make a profit. That's what trade is about for Trump. Getting a good deal means not getting screwed over in your trade deals.
And so what do you think is the difference to Hillary Clinton? You know, like, I mean,
I think Hillary Clinton thinks that the important thing is to get out of the way of these exchanges and to have as much trade and as successful, as many successful companies of different types as possible. And, you know, and that will mean supporting through the government the most powerful economic forces there are, the biggest companies there are, should be you know, given as much support as they can, so there's as little in the way as possible in order to grow the entire national and then global economy.
I do believe in trade. We are 5% of the world's population. We have to trade with the other 95%. That has, on balance, been a net plus for our economy.
Every country in the world does that, and every administration in the world does that. They support their own.
Right.
A corporation, so they.
Right. I'm not saying that's not a point of difference. The difference is whether or not you think that trade itself, whether you think of trade as a zero sum game, or if you think of the process of trade and exchange and production and all of it as something that leads to growth in itself and therefore has to be sort of, helped along and sped up and.
I'm not entirely sure what we're arguing here, you know, like, I mean, it's like, I agree that you can think of the, you know, like trade not being a zero sum game, you know, like, and ideally this is the world, you know, like we should be living in, but, you know, like sort of the last, you know, like hundreds of years of history have proven that it's just not the way it ends up being.
The difference between you and me is I have a different, hold on. I have a different, I know I'm interrupting you, but I'm just going to be less polite to my reactionary enemies. Here's the thing. Let me just say this. You and I have a different theory as to why that hasn't worked. You and I have a different theory as to why the trades aren't generating the profit and why there's been crisis. That's what's important, is that you and I don't agree about why the system hasn't been functioning the way Hillary Clinton thinks it should. Why this utopian vision of constant growth through, you know, greasing the tracks of exchange and trade isn't working. We have different theories about that. All right, go ahead.
I don't think that's Hillary Clinton's theory at all. Like, not just for the record, you know, like, I mean, I think she's like the Clinton State Department has proven that they don't give a shit, you know, they just want power, you know, like, I mean, look at what they've done to Syria and Libya. You know, that doesn't sound like prosperity for all, you know. Gaddafi proposed a currency backed by gold, you know, like that could have worked, you know, easily.
Well, look, there, you know, there's theory and then there's what you have to do in practice to get that to happen. I mean, I you know, we'd have to go well into the weeds to see how the neoliberal agenda fits with the policies about the Middle East. But one thing you can say is that these things like the Arab Spring and massive uprisings become hindrances to the corporate powers in the region, including the Saudis.
You've got that entirely wrong. Like, look, the Arab Spring. You should listen. There's the French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas. Yeah, and he said on television that the uprising in Syria, that was planned by the British 2 years before it happened.
The uprising in Syria was. About in Egypt? What about
Egypt
in Tunisia?
Well, Egypt, you know, I know that because I worked for like this NGO sector in Berlin back in the day, and I can tell you that, you know, like the State Department and the U.S. embassies, they fund these movements, you know, and that doesn't mean that these people don't have any like grievances. No, but you know, those things are exacerbated politically, you know, like, and those things are, you know, like supported materially, and that's not as easy as just people rising up and then, you know, like changing the world. That's not how these things happen, you know.
Obviously, it's not how things happen, because the Arab Spring fell apart and wasn't successful, and there's a multitude of reasons why.
That's what's going to happen to every revolution, because those things, they've lost their innocence, so they're not even, they shouldn't even be on the radar, you know. People have to entirely alter their strategies, you know. That doesn't work ever. When does that ever work, you know? Those are geopolitical extinction mechanisms.
So you think that these movements of the masses to take charge of their life are always manipulated by elites?
Yeah, they become, inevitably. That doesn't mean that there's no grievances and that they're not real. But once these things happen, it's so easy, you know, like once there's a little bit of chaos and instability, you know, like there's, you know, like there's sort of a foreign foreign ministries entirely specialized on disrupting these things.
Probably some of what you say about, for instance, plans to help along the Syrian uprising that might have come out of the UK, I don't doubt that that's possibly true, and to some degree, in order to figure out to trace out the actual causation of political events, it takes a long, painstaking study and survey of the history.
I'm not saying, look, you can't be a country and like just like, oh, I'm gonna like make an uprising and then it's gonna work. Of course, you work with the local factors and you work with economic factors, and a lot of these uprisings were caused by economic hardship, and you know, like this is why, you know, you turn the sanctions wheel, and then you put countries into trouble and you destabilize them. I mean, that's what you can see in Venezuela, for example. You know, like, for example, like where I usually disagree with the right, it's like the simplistic vision of like, oh, that's socialism in Venezuela, that's why things don't work and there's breadlines. Yeah, right. You know, like you really have to be an idiot to believe that. You know, you look at, you know, like all of the factors in the region, and then you try to figure out what's happening.
Do you think that the American Revolution, way back in the day, was a conspiracy by the French?
I have no idea about that. You know,
interested international parties are going to always kind of get involved with domestic disputes or uprisings.
Yeah.
The American Revolution was helped along by the French, who were enemies of the British.
No, if you have supporting state actors, you know, like, I mean, that's, you know, like these things, I'm not saying, yeah, that's a good point, essentially, you know, like if you have like sort of stability guarantees, then these things can go right. But then you also have to see like the American Revolution, that is a long time ago, you know, and a lot of things have changed ever since then. And today it's easier than ever to create chaos. You know, like, but it also depends on, you know, what state are you talking about? What society are you talking about? You know, that's, for example, you've been talking about North Korea, you know, like this people are so disciplined and like sticking together, you know, like it would be difficult to create any sort of chaos there. I think that's where like a lot of, you know, the U.S. has been biting its teeth out, you know, like because these people are just so disciplined. You know, you try the same thing in Kenya, you know, like it's just, yeah, you set off some bombs at the market, and basically like the country is in chaos.
So let me ask you something on off to the side here. What do you think of Mencius Moldbug and his politics? Because I know he's sort of like a major figure for Jacobite magazine, and he considers himself to be a Jacobite. And also, by the way, what does the term Jacobite actually refer to?
Oh man, like I think the Jacobite is like I think Catholic Restoration, but I'm not really, you know.
Yeah, it's a return. Yeah, so, you want to restore the Stuarts.
Just to make things clear, like I'm observing these things, and I really like reading Jacobite because I learn things too. But I'm not familiar with all of the canon of thought, you know. Like I do come from a you know, like anti-imperialist perspective and background, and rather on the left. So like my culture would be much more left wing, like just from the stuff that I read, than this stuff. And I've started reading Mencius Moldbug, and I didn't think it held up very well. You know, I think it was the same thing. It was basically like his instances were just like, you know, history as seen through an American propaganda lens, you know, like, and not very interested in what factual debates are about these events actually are. And like, you know, there are some, I think, catchy terms from Mencius Moldbug, like the cathedral, you know, and, you know, like, I think that's funny, you know, like, I mean, he may as well have called it the synagogue, you know, like, but, you know, like maybe that's, you know, like collective unconscious or something. But I mean, you know, like I'm not really familiar with this stuff. Like I started reading it, and you know, like, and it, maybe that's because I started reading it chronologically. I didn't find it very interesting. Maybe it gets more interesting, but I don't know. Like I don't know. Like I know there's a cult on Twitter of like, you know, like obscure things that I'm sort of observing from afar. You know, like, and some of that I find interesting. I think there's a lot of really good poets in that way, but you know, like, that's not really political serious. A lot of the stuff that they're producing, it's just like producing memes about Nick Land, you know, like, and having like discussions on like what patchwork and stuff, you know.
You don't align yourself with his racism, then?
Look, I think Nick Land, like, first of all, like the Jacobite essays of Nick Land, they're fantastic, they're brilliant. You know, but like, and I think he's an interesting sort of, you know, like poet, but like, I don't know enough about him, you know, like I know his, like his Twitter is kind of frivolous, you know, like I don't really know what his agenda is. Like, I think he seems to be completely oblivious to the idea that there's epigenetics. And I'm not a fan of a system where people are like entirely, you know, like this, you know, the race realism thing, you know, like that's like a demon, you know, like, I mean, where are you going to go with that? You know, like, that doesn't make any sense to me. Like, do you want your ethno state or something?
Well, okay. So let me just finish this off with this, because we've been talking for about an hour and I feel like it went about as well as it could. But I do want to ask you this. Do you understand that? As someone who, and maybe you want to ask me about my progressivism or whatever, but as someone who considers himself to be a socialist,
yeah,
and considers the publication or the house that I'm working for, the imprint, to be broadly socialist,
yeah,
that authors that not only get published by publications like Jacobite, which by the way, I wouldn't necessarily tell an author, oh, since you've been published and Jacobite, you can never be published here again. I wouldn't tell Michael Tracy, who's been published in the American Conservative, that I don't want him writing for us. But I would say that between the differences between Zero Books and Jacobite as a publication, and the American Conservative too, are severe enough that someone who's writing for either publication, not as an outlier, not as a left critic that can't find another place, but in the house style, just isn't going to find a home here with Zero Books. That's not what we do. And that's not what we're about.
Man, that's all fine. You know, like you pursue your brand, but you know, like I think you should, you know, like you see this here, you know, we're having a nice discussion and we're making some progress.
Yes. I think that in order for us to make real progress, we'd have to do this a lot and go slower than we did this time.
Well, fair enough. You know, like, but you know, like if you start, like, it's just like my general point is, and people, or you should perhaps read my essay that's called Historiography Wars, you know, which is my first essay that they published on Jacobite, you know, which is about, you know, like that saying that that's pretty much as subversive as it gets if people from like different ideological affiliations talk to each other, you know. And, you know, like, I'm just saying, you know, like, if you stop talking to other people, you know, like, who are not entirely crazy, but people who make serious arguments, and I would include myself in that, then you kind of start becoming the reactionary.